I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Donald Trump's unfounded allegation that President Obama founded ISIS, something he said repeatedly this week, has dominated the news. Meanwhile, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton both went to Michigan this week to give economic speeches, laying out their plans to create jobs, strengthen the economy, deal with trade deals, and address our tax system. Not surprisingly, they criticized each other's proposals. Clinton, who spoke at a tool and engineering company, told Trump supporters that he really only cares about rich people like him. Trump, who spoke in Detroit, said the city was the living and breathing example of Obama and Clinton's failed economic agenda. Well, today on Radio Times, we want to fact check and analyze their two policies, and we have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studio is Robert Farley. He's the deputy managing editor of factcheck.org, and that's part of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Robert Farley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning. And joining us by telephone is Jim Tankersley, economic policy correspondent at the Washington Post. And Jim Tankersley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much.
Jim, let me begin with you. Would you say that talking about the economy, jobs, taxes, that this is something that probably all Americans care about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not just saying that because I'm biased, because it's what I write about. I'm saying it because I think it's clearly in the polls one of, or if not the most dominant issue that voters feel still in their lives. And we're many years now clear of a devastating financial crisis, but the healing is not over. And I think people are really still feeling the effects of low growth, of a job market that is only now finally getting back toward full employment, and the fact that wages are only now starting to rise for the majority of Americans. I think you put all those things together and you have a lot of economic issues the candidates need to deal with.
And would it also be fair to say that this recovery from the recession has exposed problems with our economic system?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think the recession exposed problems. The recovery has exposed problems. The biggest problem it's exposed is a problem that has been sitting there for all to see for a while, but has been put in much sharper relief, which is that the vast majority of American workers aren't getting ahead.
Right.
And they haven't gotten ahead for at least 15 years. So that's a structural problem in the economy that both these candidates are trying to confront.
Bob, you and your colleagues have been fact-checking both of the speeches, Donald Trump's speech earlier in the week and Hillary Clinton's speech yesterday, a lot of detail. Is there a certain takeaway as you compare these two speeches that were given this week?
Well, it's politics, so you find both sides sort of spinning things to put the best face on their statistics that they want to provide. But yes, we found that both candidates spun the data quite a bit.
In part because they're both running for the White House, and this is a political season.
Well, they call it the silly season for a reason. Yeah.
Let me go back to you, Jim. Looking at these two speeches and also what the candidates have said leading up to this week, is there a Trump economic policy? Is there a Clinton economic policy that you can see?
Yeah, both of them have, I think, very very well-defined economic policies, if not the most detailed, in particularly in Donald Trump's case. But it's some competing and actually, oddly enough, occasionally overlapping philosophies. Donald Trump is basically one part traditional supply-side Republican economics, tax cuts, reducing regulations, trying to free businesses to spend more money and hire more people, and then another part very strongly anti-trade populism. So that's very new for a Republican candidate, and it makes Trump unique, I think, in the Republicans we've seen in modern America running for president. But that's an ethos, and it's those two things put together. Clinton is much more complicated. She has like a 5.5 bucket, however you want to describe it, plan that essentially seeks to attack from a variety of angles all of the things she sees as having gone wrong for workers in the labor market, and trying to find ways to give them relief through more government or more spending or new programs or more help.
And we're talking about things like college and child care, things like that.
Yeah, mandatory paid family leave, help to hold down child care costs, debt-free college for everyone. She's trying increased skill training for workers, raising taxes on the rich to fund some of these programs, a big infrastructure investment, which Donald Trump wants to do also, by the way, to actually create jobs through government spending. you see with Clinton this idea that basically the economy is not working for workers, so she wants to put a lot of government thumbs on the scale to try to either help those workers or to goose the economy in more of a pro-worker direction. And like the minimum wage, for example, a big increase in the minimum wage would be another one of those things.
You mentioned the word infrastructure. Let me play a clip. And this is a speaking in Warren, Michigan yesterday. This is Hillary Clinton laying out her economic agenda, which has a lot to do with infrastructure. Let's give it a listen.
I believe every American willing to work hard should be able to find a job that provides dignity, pride, and decent pay that can support a family. So starting on day one, we will work with both parties to pass the biggest investment in new, good-paying jobs since World War II. We will put Americans to work, building and modernizing our roads, our bridges, our tunnels, our railways, our ports, our airports.
Robert Farley, what's your response to that? And in a sense, who could argue with that?
Right. There's not much for a fact checker in that. That's an opinion or a policy that she'd like to do. For us, we concentrate on those things that we can objectively say are misleading, and that's more of a rhetorical promise.
Let me go to you, Jim Tankersley, and she talks about infrastructure, the largest investment since World War II. Now, after the recession, the president had part of the stimulus package had to deal with infrastructure. How do you see this proposal?
I see it, first off, as something that she won't say it this way, but this is a classic Keynesian stimulus of the economy. It's the idea that if the government spends more money, you're going to try to create more economic activity that's going to create more growth. But it's also, from a longer-term perspective, a uniquely good time to do this. Interest rates are very low. America's infrastructure needs are quite high based on a lot of reports. So you can see in her argument both a case to goose the economy, but also a case to take advantage of a very opportune moment to make investments. And again, Donald Trump has said this too. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the criticisms of these always end up being, well, the government already has a lot of debt. How are we going to pay for it? And secondly, is it possible for the government to find enough shovel-ready projects or whatever you're going to call them to actually complete the kind of infrastructure work that she's talking about?
And is there also a question about whether if she becomes the president and we have the same Republican-controlled Congress that they would want to work with her on this?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, I guess that's the question for Donald Trump, too. I mean, if he has a Republican-controlled Congress, how will he get them to spend more money on infrastructure? The thing that Democrats often say, which is true, is that the infrastructure is a thing that Republicans have often wanted to spend government money on, and that the business community, which is very important for Republican political donations, desperately wants the government to spend more money on. I think the thing Republicans would say is that they would be happy to do that if the trade-off was some spending cuts elsewhere. Mm. And so that's where the negotiations will be. Can Hillary Clinton, if she becomes president, find some package of things that includes more infrastructure spending, cuts elsewhere, maybe changes in long-run payouts from safety net programs for the government, something that will bring enough Republicans on board to pass a plan.
Let me play another clip, and this is at the Detroit Economic Club on Monday. Donald Trump, here he is making a claim about the number of people who are, quote, outside of the labor force.
Meanwhile, American households are earning more than $4,000. Think of that. $4,000 less today than they were 16 years ago. The average worker today pays 31.5% of their wages to income and payroll taxes. On top of that, state and local taxes consume another 10%. Very grim picture.
And again, that was Donald Trump speaking earlier this week. A terrible audio. We apologize for that. We looked for multiple examples that didn't have some of those fallouts or whatever we were listening to. But nonetheless, we wanted our listeners to hear the whole speech. So as you look at that, Robert Farley, how would you rate that, if I can put it that
way? Well, one of the things is he claimed that household income is $4,000 less than it is today than it was 16 years ago. And he's using some outdated figures there. That's from 2014. Some census data figures. Now, we have more up-to-date figures from a private company that looks into this, and household income as of June was at $57,000, a little over $57,000, about $620 less than it was 16 years ago. So probably not a huge doesn't make people feel much better about that,
right.
But it's not. It's an inflated figure to say 4,000.
Well, you want to weigh in on this as well, Jim? And as you said, we know this. People are hurting.
I mean, I agree. I mean, it's true that the private data show this uptick, and I am very confident that the government data will show it when the census figures, the next round of census figures, come out in September. I am always wary, though, of saying that. Politicians are not telling the truth when they are citing the most recent official government statistic. I guess I see this both ways, mm-hmm. but I think it's hard to fault the candidate for saying basically based on the most recent official data we have. I mean, there are plenty of other estimates, but the most recent official data that we have is that incomes are below where they were at the start of the century. And I think in general, he is reflecting whether we use the Centier, which is the private figure numbers now, or the official figures, he's still reflecting this feeling that people have, which is that they haven't gotten a raise over this whole time, and they feel like they're working harder, but they're not getting ahead. And I think we could all agree that the data, basically any way you slice them, show that that's true for this stretch.
Jim, these candidates, not surprisingly, were very critical of each other's plans. Do you think that sticks with listeners more than an outline or a description of what they might do if they become president?
I do think that attack lines stick with voters, which is why we see politicians use them so much. I think I wrote about this last month. One of the criticisms of Secretary Clinton is that she talks in such sweeping detail at times, or even when she's not detailed, she talks in such length about her plans that it's hard for people to get a sense of, like, what's the crystallized message? What's the elevator pitch of what you'll do for me. She's working on that. This speech this week was a clear distillation of that. But in part, she's working on it by putting her plans in opposition to Trump's. And Trump is doing the same. He is making a very familiar, but we have seen in the past, effective attack, which is that she would raise taxes and he would cut them. So both candidates, in a weird way, are finding some clarity to their plans by positioning them in opposition to their opponent's plans. And we do know from, you know, years and years and years of political campaigns that voters respond to contrasts.
Absolutely. And we're almost up in a break here, Rob. Is it hard to fact check these two candidates, especially when delving into their economic plans?
Well, for example, when you had Trump earlier in the week claiming that Clinton wanted to raise taxes on the middle class, that's something we can look at. And then the Tax Policy Center looked at that, and they said that the bottom 95% of taxpayers would see little or no change in their taxes under Clinton's plan. That's because most of the tax increases that she's proposed fall on the upper income folks.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are dissecting and discussing two speeches earlier this week, one by Hillary Clinton yesterday, one by Donald Trump on Monday, outlining some of their proposals to deal with some of the economic challenges. Talking with Robert Farley and Jim Tankersley. We want to talk to you. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. From tax cuts to trade deals this week, the presidential candidates, the two leading candidates, laid out their respective economic policies at separate events in Michigan, one in Detroit and one just outside of Detroit. Talking with Robert Farley, he's the deputy managing editor of factcheck.org, and Jim Tankersley, economic policy correspondent at The Washington Post. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play another clip, and this is Hillary Clinton addressing her stance on the controversial, as it has turned out to be, Trans-Pacific Partnership. Let's give it a listen, and then we'll talk about it.
I will stop any trade deal that kills jobs or holds down wages, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Oppose it now, I'll oppose it after the election, and I'll oppose it as president.
So, Jim, what's her message there?
Well, Hillary Clinton has a trick with the TPP, which is that she helped negotiate it. And so she has been fighting for a long time throughout the Democratic primaries and now the accusation that she actually would support it if she was elected. This is even though she has come out and said she opposed it. She says the final deal is not up to her standards. And this is her trying to say in very uncertain terms, very certain terms, that she would absolutely not enact the TPP as president. The immediate reaction when people reported this was that it was met with disbelief. That the people, if you're a skeptic of Hillary Clinton on trade, this does not appear to have changed your mind, but she's trying to. She's trying to reassure her supporters who are opposed to the TPP that she will not turn around and flip on it, as Democratic presidents have done in the past on trade deals, if she's president.
Is she also trying to hold on to whatever Sanders supporters she might have, or convince those who were very opposed to TPP and even some Donald Trump supporters who also opposed TPP?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think that that's definitely a group that's up for grabs here is workers, particularly white workers, blue-collar workers who feel like they've been burned by trade deals. This was a very effective attack line for Sanders in the Michigan primary, for example, and it's a line that Trump is trying to push very hard in Michigan as he tries to win the general election. So, yeah, I think that that's a big part of her strategy here is she is attempting to either hold on to those Sanders voters she's picked up or grab new ones or even pick off the Trump ones as they fight over trade.
Bob, let me ask you a couple of questions that you all looked at. One is Hillary Clinton citing some, actually a local economist here, Mark Zandi, he gets cited a lot, about whether Donald Trump's proposals would create several million jobs or 10 million jobs. Fact check that for us, if you could.
Sure. And let me first say a word about Mark Zandi, because what you hear so often from the Democrats lately is they refer to him as McCain's economic advisor back in 2008 in the campaign. Tim Kaine during the convention said he was his chief economic advisor. Not true. And earlier in the week, you had Clinton saying that he was not a Democrat. And the message here is listen to what he has to say, because that's one of them telling you that. And in fact, Mark Zandi is a longtime registered Democrat, as he told us this week, and he contributed $2,700 to her campaign in the primary. Now, he's a well-respected economist, but nonetheless, as I said, it's the Democrats are spinning this into he's one of them, and that's not the case. He's been supportive of a lot of Democratic policies over the years, including the stimulus and things like that. As for the idea that under her economic plan there'd be 10 million new jobs created in her 4 years as presidency, that's true. But Zandi's group, Moody's Analytics, found that under current law there'd be about 6 million jobs created. So you're really talking about 3.2 million more than that.
Let me go to you, Jim, and I have a question about regulation or overregulation. Donald Trump has talked about, especially I think related to the Environmental Protection Agency, the idea that overregulation has hurt the economy. Is there some truth to that, and what is he offering?
So this is one of the more hotly contested ideological ideas in economics, and it really depends on what you think about the benefits of potential regulations and how they compare to the costs. There is evidence. I mean, certainly standard economic theory suggests that when the government tells businesses what they can and can't do, that makes it harder for businesses to invest in what might be the optimal thing that the market would want. On the other hand, we have seen what happens when businesses are able to do what they want without any government regulation or with light government regulation or bad government regulation, and you get things like the financial crisis. So the argument from Democrats and liberal economists is that it is the benefits of not having financial crises and of not having catastrophic climate change and other things that we employ regulations in hopes of avoiding far outweigh the costs of imposing such regulations. What Trump is saying is that the opposite, that he thinks that regulations have done too much to gum up growth, and that he wants to pause issuing any new regulations, which would include a lot of regulations that are due to be issued under the financial reform bill passed a few years ago by Congress. So he would stop issuing those, and then he'd start looking for regulations across the government to get rid of right away.
And what about to you, Rob, about undocumented workers? As we know, immigration, of course, such a contentious issue this election season. What are we hearing from the candidates on that?
So Clinton said yesterday that undocumented workers in the U.S. are paying about $12 billion a year into the Social Security program. Now, this isn't the worst political sin we've seen, but we did point out that half of that is paid by these undocumented workers, and the other half is paid by employers. So it's not fully $12 billion paid by these workers. More of a quibble than anything else.
And what about for Trump? Did that come up at all in his speech on Monday?
You know, we didn't fact check anything particularly on immigration, that speech. As I said, it was mostly concentrated on economic policy.
On economic policy. Let me get Frank from Center City, Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Frank, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Two things about the specifics of Hillary Clinton that I think would really focus very well in creating jobs. One is transportation. And the other is the bridges. So those two areas alone would create a number of a vast number of jobs. The transportation system in this country is still woefully inadequate. If you go down to the bus stand in the morning and you knew the bus was going to be there at the time the schedule says, you would take it. And this old folk story about people having a love affair with their car is just pure nonsense. No one's saying you get rid of your car.
Well, you know what, Frank? I don't want you to go off on a tangent there, but let me take your essential point about transportation and things like bridges. And, Jim, if I can go back to you, I mean, I think anyone that lives in this country knows that we have dire and in some cases and certainly needed investments in transportation and infrastructure. We're dealing with a septa crisis here in Philadelphia. Any thoughts on that, Jim?
I mean, I live in Washington, D.C., which has arguably the worst crisis for a public transportation system happening in the country right now. I feel lucky every time I get even remotely on time between places on the metro anymore. I think there are massive problems with and shortfalls in America's public transportation systems. There are massive shortfalls in America's roads. There are bridges that need repair. There are highways that need repaving. There's congestion that needs to be cleared up. But then also, we think of infrastructure as more than just conduits to get us places. It's also now conduits for information. So we can think or electricity. So our electrical grid, overhauling our electrical grid could be and which is badly in need of an update, could be very much an infrastructure program. And broadband is one that Secretary Clinton talks about a lot. Getting broadband access to every house in the country theoretically would help many more Americans be plugged into the global economy and the global information economy.
Jim, we have to say goodbye to you. When you look at the advisors for Hillary Clinton and for Donald Trump, what's your takeaway?
Hillary Clinton has a very traditional, in fact, larger than normal stable of sort of Democratic and liberal policy hands on her team. She has academic economists. She has think tank economists. She has former top economic officials in past Democratic administrations. She has people she's known forever and people who are new to her. It's a very big group of very smart people. Donald Trump has some smart people around him, too, but it's a much smaller group and it's very non-traditional. It's mostly people who are successful in business. There is one academic economist. There is no one who has held a senior position in a previous Republican campaign or administration in an economic capacity. And this is just almost unprecedented, if not unprecedented. He's just talking to a very different type of advisors, and that's in part because he's a very different type of candidate.
And a number of them named Steve.
And many of them are named, although he did name eight women to join. It was an all-male team that he unveiled last week. And then yesterday he unveiled another nine, eight of whom were women. So that balances out on a gender basis to some degree.
Jim, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. That's Jim Tankersley, economic policy correspondent at The Washington Post. Robert Farley, the deputy managing editor of FactCheck.org, is staying with us for the rest of the hour. And now we welcome Neil Irwin to the show, a senior economics correspondent for The New York Times. He writes for The Upshot, and that's a Times site for analysis of politics and economics and much more. And Neil Irwin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I want to talk in more detail about the tax plans that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump offered this week. Your piece today imagines a Trump presidency, what would happen, and then another Clinton presidency. If Donald Trump becomes president and Congress signs off on his tax proposals from this week, who wins, who loses?
Well, the biggest change is a substantial cut in the tax for wealthy Americans, cutting the top marginal tax rate from 40% to 33%. Also introducing provisions that make the business tax much lower that would also apply to partnerships and would create a way for many individuals, especially wealthy individuals, to essentially turn their income into a much lower tax, 15% rate, much lower than the 40% wealthy Americans face today. Also a small tax cut for middle-class people, but the biggest tax cut really for the rich in the Donald Trump plan.
And how about for Clinton?
What Clinton wants to do is raise taxes on the rich through a number of different provisions that include, a surcharge for people making over $5 million a year, a few other elements of taxing the rich higher. Not much change for middle class and lower income people. She basically wants to raise taxes on the rich, use that money to fund the rest of her agenda, and leave things basically where they are for most middle class Americans.
Anything you want to add to that, Robin? Then I do want to play another clip.
No, I want to talk about this idea that Clinton wanted to raise taxes on the middle class. I don't know if that was the clip you wanted to play, but it's essentially what he's drawing on is, as I said, it's the silly season, and what we have is him seizing on something that she said, whether she said that they are or are not going to raise middle class taxes.
In fact, we will play.
We'll get to that later.
No. I was doing hand signals with my engineer, so we're all set to go. And again, this is Donald Trump laying out his economic plans, and in this, he makes some claims about his Democratic rivals' tax plans. Of course, Hillary Clinton.
Her plan would tax many small businesses by almost 50%. Recently, at a campaign event, Hillary Clinton short-circulated, you know this, you've heard this one. Hillary Clinton short-circuited again, to use a now famous term, when she accidentally told the truth and said that she wanted to raise taxes on the middle class.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, so as I said, he's seizing on a quote that she made in a speech in Nebraska. And whether or not someone heard that she said are or are not going to raise taxes on the middle class, it's a silly proposition here. Clearly in context and in the consistent message that she's delivered on the trail, she has said numerous times she does not want to raise taxes on the middle class, regardless of that. Her plan, as we discussed earlier, she talks about things that would really target upper income folks. The Buffett rule, which would require folks making over $1 million to pay a minimum of 30% tax. This surcharge on folks making over $5 million a year. Those are the real meat of where she's going to raise revenues. And the Tax Policy Center looked at it and said the bottom 95% of taxpayers would see little or no change in taxes under the Clinton plan.
Hmm. Yeah. Neil, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's correct. The other interesting dimension of all this is that, she is trying to create a structure that basically uses tax increases on some people to pay for the rest of what she's doing. The Trump approach to say we're going to cut taxes on everybody, we're going to cut them a lot for people at the upper income brackets, say that will unleash such amazing economic growth that'll pay for itself or will create a remarkable surge in growth. He's not trying to do pay-fors, as they say in Washington, to find specific policies that will offset. So the logical conclusion of that, it'll enlarge the budget deficit a great deal. Unless he's correct that there is that massive surge in economic activity because of these tax cuts.
And that's not a new idea, Neil. The idea of cutting taxes, especially for wealthy people, then they create jobs and people get employed. Has that, we've run this experiment for some time now. Is that how it works?
Certainly not enough to create a kind of offsetting effect that means the tax cuts don't raise the deficit. The experience from the 2000s when there were the Bush tax cuts in 2001, 2003, even apart from the recession and the kind of slow growth we've had since then, the simple matter is if you tax people less, less money comes into the government. The deficit rises if you don't do anything to offset it.
I think it's also interesting, I'll put this to both of you, but let me toss this to you first, Neil, which is when you begin to look at some of these plans and then some of the analysis, you realize how many people in this country do not pay taxes. And I'm not necessarily talking about rich people not paying taxes, but the fact that there's a set large segment of the population that do not make enough money in order to qualify to pay taxes. Neil?
That's right. About 45% of taxpayers do not pay federal income tax. That was the origin, by the way, of that Mitt Romney line, about 47%. And that's true. Now, keep in mind, that's just the income tax. People still, if they work, they still pay payroll tax. They still pay state tax. They still pay sales tax. So it's not as if, these 45% of taxpayers are not paying anything to the government. In fact, a lot of those people probably see money being taken out of their paycheck every 2 weeks and feel like they're paying plenty of taxes. But the simple math is that because of various tax credits and offsets, people up to relatively middle income levels, to a surprising degree, don't actually pay federal income tax.
Do you want to add to that, Rob?
No, I think that when the Tax Policy Center looked at Trump's original tax plan, which I should say has been amended this week, it concluded that there were going to be even more of people that would owe no federal income tax. Now, they've not done an analysis of his new plan. He has new tax brackets that he introduced this week.
But the question, and obviously, if the people don't pay as much taxes, there's less money going to the government, and therefore, unless you can figure out offset, you're going to increase the deficit.
The business-backed tax foundation looked at this plan, and they said that they did think that it was going to encourage economic growth. But even factoring that in, they thought that that there was going to be about a $10 trillion decrease in revenues over a decade. Now, Trump has not been terribly specific about how he's going to offset that with tax cuts. So we're waiting to see on that.
And that's Robert Farley, Deputy Managing Editor of FactCheck.org. Also with us, Neil Irwin, Senior Economics Correspondent for The New York Times. He writes for The Upshot. And we are dissecting and discussing the tax plans, the economic plans outlined this week by Hillary Clinton and also by Donald Trump. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, talking with Neil Irwin and Robert Farley about some of the proposals outlined this week by Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. How could I forget? And you can, again, join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Neil, this is perhaps a partisan question, but it is interesting to read about and hear Donald Trump talking about his tax proposals when he has not released his own personal taxes. How much pressure on him to do that?
I think we'll keep hearing that through the campaign as we get to November. Obviously these are separate issues. What policies he proposes for the country versus what disclosure and what he releases about his own situation are different things, but they do kind of interact in the sense that, if you want to know how much these tax proposals would affect his personal tax burden, we can run that math with Hillary Clinton because we have her taxes over the years. At this point, we can't do that with Donald Trump and see how much he would gain. It appears to be he would gain a lot, partly because he has a lot of money coming in through limited liability companies, other types of partnerships, and one of the key parts of his proposal is to dramatically reduce taxes on businesses, including those partnerships. Also, the estate tax, his own family potentially has a lot to gain when he passes on one day. If his kids want to get those assets without paying estate tax, they would benefit if the estate tax is eliminated, as he would like to see.
Well, Hillary Clinton talked about that, and here she is speaking yesterday, criticizing Donald Trump for his elimination of the estate tax.
And then there's the estate tax, which Trump wants to eliminate altogether. Now, if you believe that he's as wealthy as he says, that alone would save the Trump family $4 billion. It would do nothing for 99.8% of Americans. So they'd get a $4 billion tax cut, and 99.8% of Americans would get nothing.
Rob, is she right?
Well, she's certainly right that the estate tax falls on relatively few people. Less than one out of 500 estates were subject to federal estate tax in 2014. So, and this is because the first $5.4 million is exempt from the estate tax. It's double that for couples. And then over that, there's an estate tax rate at 40%. But because of that high threshold, there was less than 5,000 people in 2014 who had to pay an estate tax. And that's out of 2.6 million deaths. So it's relatively few that pay that.
And interestingly, Neil, the estate tax has been rebranded as the death tax. What kind of support is there for the estate tax for people that would never benefit from it?
You know, it's interesting. This is an area where the polling actually, you know, my recollection, I don't have anything in front of me, is that people, you know, you describe it to people, they don't like the idea of people having to pay taxes on their estates, people having to pay taxes when they die. That said, compared to, you know, 10, 15 years ago, those exemptions really have been pushed up a great deal. You know, it used to be that some you know, affluent but not filthy, you know, not really wealthy families were having to be entrapped in that estate tax. I think the exemption used to be $600,000 or something.
Yeah.
Now, as Robert says, it's $5.5 million almost for an individual. That's almost $11 million for a couple. You know, this is families that are quite wealthy who are being hit with this thing now.
Let me get Barbara from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Barbara, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm calling because people talk over and over again about cutting all these regulations, how they're such evil things, how they hurt business. But nobody seems to talk about why we have so many of them in the first place. And that is because we need the public safety, from auto seatbelts to emission things that help our health. To, well, right now with all these amusement park accidents, the first thing people say is, oh, we need more regulations. Hmm. And then everyone turns around and says, regulations are so evil. Workplace regulations, where if the companies themselves put the safety, well, we'll say regulations, the safety policies in place, the accidents wouldn't happen that need the regulations. But they don't do it because that cuts profits, supposedly.
Well, you know, Barbara, let me take your point. And actually, this came up with Jim Tankersley and Neil Irwin. I'll put this to you. And I guess depending on which side of the regulation you're on, you might have a different perspective on it. But, you know, this is something that that Donald Trump certainly talked about the onerousness of regulations.
Yeah, I mean, look, every single regulation on the books, whether you like it or don't, exists for some reason. It was created to address some problem that existed in society, in the business world, whatever it might be. You know, the Dodd-Frank Act, again, you don't have to like it, but we had this horrible financial crisis in 2008, and it's clear that our financial system was very vulnerable and you know, capable of falling apart in a way that created just a horrible, horrible recession. The idea the government would try and do something to stop that from happening is, you know, isn't crazy at all. I think the question comes down to, you know, are all of these regulations on the books, are they still fulfilling their purpose? Do they create benefits for society that are worth the cost that's paid for companies complying and that sort of thing? And, you know, that's why I think it's tough to even talk about when Donald Trump calls for a across-the-board moratorium on regulations. Well, not all regulations are created equal. And, you know, it's hard to talk about it in the abstract without talking about specific things. All right, what do you want on bank capital requirements? What do you want on environmental protection? You name it, consumer protection. So it's a, you know, to just do a broad brush stroke is very tough on this issue.
Ron, one of the things that Donald Trump said earlier in the week is that by repealing the Affordable Care Act, the country would save something like 2 million American jobs. What's the truth or untruth on that?
Well, it's really a misnomer to call those, you know, a cut in jobs, because, and it sounds like I'm parsing words here, but it's that 2 million people would 2 million fewer people would want to work. Now it sounds odd, but what you have is people that are working to keep their insurance, deciding that because of the Affordable Care Act they no longer need to, or they may retire earlier. So that's a good deal of that 2 million in that figure. So it's not that you're losing 2 million jobs. It's that there's a number of people that would choose not to work more.
And Neil, we're talking about these proposals. This is the guy's, I guess, the fantasy part of a presidential campaign. And then comes the hard reality if you get the job and then trying to get this stuff done. We've been talking a lot about what both of the candidates said this week. Is this kind of pie in the sky stuff?
You know, you can't just take these proposals that are issued and assume that's what's going to become law. Obviously, things have to go through Congress. There are negotiations. There's all kinds of stuff. In the case of Trump, the plans themselves are pretty vague. You know, we on taxes, maybe a little less so than on other subjects. But, you know, this is not a policy operation he's running. There's not a lot of detail being issued by his camp. Hillary Clinton, there's more so. So on the one hand, don't take this stuff too literally. It doesn't mean mm-hmm. that if Hillary Clinton's elected, this will become the law of the land. At the same time, what a candidate talks about and what they emphasize and what their priorities are, it tells us a lot about how they're going to govern and what their focus is going to be. You know, Barack Obama in 2008 talked about raising taxes on the wealthy, and that's what happened. You know, taxes on the top income bracket went from 35% to 39.6%. There's a surcharge through Medicare to pay for Obamacare. You know, it's not that every single thing that Barack Obama was proposing in 08 has become law, but in terms of broad brushstrokes and direction, we definitely got, you know, what people voted for. Same with George Bush in 2000. Same with, you know, Bill Clinton in 1992. So this stuff matters, even if you can't take it too literally in terms of what's going to end up on the books.
Just a quick question. I know you have to leave us, Neil. And you mentioned this earlier about if you're in the real estate business, it seems as if we have a very friendly tax code when it comes to all the deductions and, I guess, ways that income is calculated. Is that a correct description, do you think?
There's a key part of the Trump plan is to make business income, including partnership incomes, sole proprietorships, taxed at a much lower rate than it is now, 15%. That's good for real estate. That's good for people who run funds. That's good for anybody who can hire tax advisors to kind of structure their income as business income, even if they're in a normal sense of the way of thinking or an ordinary income.
Neil Irwin, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's a senior economics correspondent for The New York Times, writes for The Upshot. And again, Robert Farley is staying with us for the rest of the hour, deputy managing editor of factcheck.org. That's part of the Annenberg Public Policy Center here at the University of Pennsylvania. And by here, I mean here in Philadelphia. And we've been talking about the two economic plans that have been outlined this week coming from Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And I do want to play a clip that's getting a lot of attention as well. But before I do that. Let me go back to you, Rob. Since your group has looked at both of these speeches in such detail, anything that we forgot that you want to make sure our listeners know about?
There was a good point that was just raised about, you know, what can you actually get accomplished? And one of the things we talked about earlier was Hillary Clinton referring to this Moody's Analytics report that said that, you know, that she would create 3.2 million jobs over what the 6 million that expected to be created. That's under if everything that she wants to get done gets done. Moody's Analytics doesn't think that's going to happen. There's a divided Congress, and they give what they call a most likely scenario. Mm-hmm. And they say that there's probably going to be a lot of political discord and that there will be substantial roadblocks to a lot of her policies. And so you have to look at those as well. And when you look at theirs, the job creation isn't quite as rosy because and the same thing holds with Trump. The same thing when they talk about the number of job losses, they don't expect that he's going to get all his policies through. And so the job there would actually be some job gains, not as many as under current law, they say, with Trump. But it's not nearly as dire a picture as they paint as if he was be able to get through everything he wants to get through.
Well, let me play a clip, and this has been played time and time again. This is at a rally in Florida on Wednesday. Donald Trump claiming that President Obama founded the jihadist militant group ISIS. Let's give it a listen.
President Obama, he is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. Okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
Now, I'm turning to you, Rob. I think it's fair to say that President Obama did not found ISIS. And Donald Trump was given multiple opportunities to provide some nuance to what he just said, but he seemed to double down on it. How do you fact check something like this?
Well, we spoke to some experts about the founding and expansion of the Islamic State, and they told us that this can't be pinned on this troop withdrawal alone. So his argument is that we left Iraq too early, and that this created an environment for ISIS to grow. In fact, though, we pull out a quote from 2007 that Trump gave to CNN, and I'll read it because it's interesting. He says, the U.S. should declare victory and leave because I'll tell you, this country is just going to get further bogged down. This is a total catastrophe, and you might as well get out now because you're just wasting time. So there you have him, what it seems to be expressing some support for a troop withdrawal. But there's so many other factors. There was the war itself in Iraq. There's the civil war in Syria, and in particular, when he points the finger at Hillary Clinton and says that she's culpable as well, it should be noted that she actually was a proponent of arming some of the resistance folks in Syria, and she wanted to keep she was also a proponent of keeping a contingency force in Iraq.
And what's interesting is that if he had said some version of what you just said, Rob, I think people would have not come down on him so hard. I mean, he's such a wily person, if I can put it that way, to try to fact check. Or maybe he's not. Maybe it's just completely out there in the open.
Yeah, these are the kinds of things that you hear on campaign trails. The rhetoric gets ramped up, and I anticipate that the closer it gets to the election, the more the rhetoric will get ramped up on both sides.
But do you see it as a both sides issue? And again, I'm not trying to be partisan here. I know some of these other fact-checking organizations, when they sort of list who told the biggest whoppers and who told the least big whoppers, there's a huge disparity between Trump and Clinton.
Well, I will tell you, I've been doing fact-checking for a number of years now. And I will tell you that neither party has cornered the market on stretching the truth. Now, that being said, we don't rate claims. We just look at them contextually. However, we did at the end of the year, we gave Donald Trump the title King of Whoppers because we concluded that there was just such a large number of untruths. And interestingly, that he would not move away from, even after, they were clearly shown to be incorrect. But that being said, if you go on the site, you'll see there's plenty of fact checks of Clinton on there. And as I said, neither party has cornered the market on that.
I've asked this of other organizations that fact check what political people say, whether what you do makes a difference. I mean, whether if someone is a Trump supporter or a Hillary Clinton supporter, whether giving them the facts that contradicts what the candidate says, whether that actually changes someone's mind.
I think certainly there are many that it doesn't. However, I will tell you, our traffic is through the roof.
Is it?
And it's much greater than it was back in 2012. That tells me people are looking for facts, and they want a nonpartisan voice in there, which you don't see a whole lot of on the web. So I do think people are looking for that. How much it changes their opinion? Maybe they're just reading the fact checks that agree with their political opinion. I don't know. And I'm sure that that's the case for some. But I like to think there are some people that are looking to find out the facts and to make informed decisions based on those.
Well, and I must say, I mean, what your group does is so detailed. I don't know if you – were you up all night putting together your list for today?
We put in a late night last night. And I will tell you that during the conventions, we put in extremely late nights. It does. It takes a lot of time. I think people want instant fact checking, and that's very difficult to do unless you've done it before because it does. It takes time to unwind these claims and find out where they got them from.
I noticed on CNN when Trump talked about President Obama founding ISIS, they had on the crawl, in parentheses, not true.
Right. We've seen that a few times now from CNN. And I think that's an interesting thing. It's a dangerous thing, too, because if you get it wrong and you call someone out for being wrong, you better make sure you're right.
Rob Farley, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Deputy Managing Editor of FactCheck.org. We also spoke with Jim Tankersley, Economic Policy Correspondent at The Washington Post, and Neil Irwin, Senior Economics Correspondent for The New York Times. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. Download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Send us an email. Sign up for a newsletter. Listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moss. Cohen, thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.